city of Beaky Blinders, Birmingham, England, I would like to introduce you to... Paddy Danda.
Hi there. Welcome to the Beaky Agilist podcast, where I get curious about all things agile. Simply put, agile is about responding to change as quickly as possible, which can be pretty useful in today's fast-paced world. In each episode, I'll be inviting authors, thought leaders, and a few friends to share their stories and insights in everyday language that even I can understand. So sit back, grab a samosa or two, and enjoy. So I'm absolutely ecstatic about today's special guest. Not only is he a serial entrepreneur that has reached the heights that many of us can only dream of, but he's also responsible for giving 30 million people an identity by disrupting the mainstream music industry. So a huge hello, Kidda, and Sat Sri Akal to Ninda Johel.
And all three to you. Sat Sri Akal, hello, and what a great, great afternoon.
Thank you, Ninda. And it's a real pleasure to have you on the show today. And happy Vaisakhi, by the way.
Oh, yes, and same to you.
Thank you. And how did you and the family celebrate under lockdown?
Well, yeah, that was extraordinary, really. I think it was more a case of just sharing pictures and talking to people virtually. But obviously, I tell you what was really strange. Normally, around April, when we have Vaisakhi, normally on the day itself, it's freezing cold. This year, it was very warm, but we couldn't go out. Extraordinary.
It's ironic, isn't it? Yeah, yes. Absolutely agree. Agility is a hot topic for many startups and corporates looking to survive in today's world of digital disruption. And I'm really keen to hear about your experiences and advice, having spent most of your career in one of the most disruptive industries of all, which is the music and entertainment industry. Could you tell us a little bit about your journey and where it all started? And what are some of your biggest highlights?
Okay, well, look, I was born in Birmingham. So I suppose I did the traditional sort of British Asian route, which is I went to university. I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do at university, but all I do remember at that young age that accountants always seemed to wear suits. And my understanding of the world was that everybody needs an accountant. So I thought the world of finance would be the place to aim. So I did my first degree in accountancy and finance.
Okay.
So I remember it's because they wore suits and I thought they looked smart in suits. and then so I got a pretty good degree. So then I set about trying to get a training contract. Within those sort of 8 short weeks after graduating, I must have had about 16 interviews. But unfortunately, I failed all of them.
Oh, and, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, there was clearly a message from the accountancy profession that they didn't want me. So we now ventured into September. So it was looking a bit close now. What the hell do I do with myself? So I'd heard of something called an MBA, a Master's in Business Administration. Knew little about it because obviously it was all sort of panicky stations now. So I got hold of, remember the thing called the Yellow Pages?
Oh.
Well, I thumbed through the Yellow Pages looking for the nearest university, which was Aston, and got myself under an MBA, and then managed to land myself a consultancy role within Lucas Engineering and Systems. And basically, to cut a long story short, we were sent all around the country looking at business units, in other words, business enterprises that were failing. And normally the give-tell sign was that there was poor liquidity, poor cash flow. And we were asked to go in there and sort them out. So we were basically hatchets. But whilst I was doing that job, I was also enjoying my music. So I was a tabla player with the Chonic, it's a Bhangra band. And so whilst during the day I was doing this hatchet job, in the evenings I was getting to my car, joining the band, whichever part of the UK, doing a gig at night. There were normally evening shows at various nightclubs. Then getting back in the morning early, about 4 or 5 o'clock, and then a couple of hours later, venturing into work as the hatchet man. So it was... it was a, yeah, it was a, I don't know if you call it moonlighting, but I was doing sort of two jobs in effect. One was for pleasure and one was my day job. Eventually, the late nights start to take toll. So I suppose, something that nobody would applaud at the time was I jacked my job in. I remember going in and saying, look, I'm leaving now. And they said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I play for a band. Yes, they said, we know. I said, well, I'm now going to set up a record company. Now, nobody in the Asian community understood what a record company was. They just didn't understand. So their understanding of a record company was that it was somebody, you know, Trotter, remember the guy with the yellow little three-wheeler?
Oh, yeah, the Only Fools and Horses guy.
That's it. So that was their impression, that I'd be driving something like that, open the back boot, and out would come all these CDs and cassettes. So I think their picture of me was a trader selling CDs and cassettes. And that was my route into self-employment, entrepreneurship, and the music industry. Although I had learned quite a bit from running the Achanak band, because not only was I a musician, I was a tabla player, but I was actually the manager as well. So I did all the organizational side and leadership side of things. So really, I was leading and managing a band of 18, 19-year-olds, creatives, very, very strong creatives, at an interesting age, and getting them organized, working in a team. Was, I didn't know at the time I was learning these skills, but that really was my first understanding of leadership and entrepreneurship.
I'm just putting myself in your shoes for a moment. And I remember I actually, having finished my degree, came home one day and a friend of mine was setting up a Subway franchise. And I said to my dad at the time, I said, hey, do you think we should perhaps do something like this? And his reaction was, we didn't send you to university for 4 years for you then to be making sandwiches for the rest of your career. So I can only imagine what the reaction might have been from your parents.
Yeah, well, the reaction there was that I was getting into a market, into a profession which didn't require any qualifications. I'd wasted the benefit of 2 degrees. I'd wasted and was going to waste a lucrative career in management consultancy to pursue what looked like a hobby. But to me now, the question might be, why would I want to do that? Well, firstly, I was enjoying the music. But secondly, I had this dream, because we were doing a lot of shows at the time. I thought the music was fantastic. And I honestly thought that one day this music could cross into the charts. And the only way to do that was to go for it. And that's when the idea of the label came up. And the fact that, you know, as you know, if your heart's not in what you do, then you'd be silly to carry on doing something where your heart's, but if there's a passion you've got, then there's a time and place. And that was the time and place. And I had this vision, this dream. The dream was that one day we would cross into the charts. And that's what led me to pursue that dream.
Wow. I think many Punjabis all around the world are probably so glad that you did pursue that dream. And we hopefully talk a little bit about where that led to eventually.
Yep.
But if we just focus on Achanak for a moment,
yep.
I remember part of my childhood, Bhangra was a big part of being a British Asian, right?
In
the UK and probably worldwide. I mean, in places like America, Canada, where there was a big Punjabi population. And I just remember Achanak, well, we're all over the place. You guys were on TV, on Network East, I think it was a BBC program.
Yep, that's right.
You know, you're literally everywhere performing gigs. Can you just explain to us that feeling, that whole journey at that time? What was that like?
Well, what we did was, and I think this is where the MBA did come in, was that we took the entire Achanak project as not just a musical project, but as a business project. And so we were one of the very first to do what would now be called a pop video. And then you saw it on a TV channel called the BBC Network East. So that was something new. We also looked at the marketplace and noticed how other bands were dressing. So we deliberately dressed differently. We managed to get, I know this is really, really strange, but we managed to get a corporate sponsor on board at that age. It was a chain of shops, retail outlets, fashion wear called Cheerio Chaterio.
Oh, I remember those. Yes.
Yeah. And what happened was they came on board and they sponsored and gave us a really, really good price on the suits. And so suddenly we were in the commercial world as well. And we were perceived now as a huge band with corporate sponsors. And when that came on board, then suddenly the whole image changed. And, of course, we invested a lot of equipment. I still remember, bought the first mobile phone. £1,200 it cost.
Wow.
And, of course, in the earlier months when people started to work out what a mobile phone was and they realized you had a mobile phone, they'd put the phone down straight away because they realized it was very expensive. But the experience itself, you know, when you're in the zone, you don't realize what's around you, if that makes sense. So we did what we had to do, which was rehearse, get the products ready, release the products, and then, of course, perform at all these shows. But we didn't understand the ripple effect outside, if that makes sense, because you're really in a bit of a bubble. We now appreciate it, but we didn't at the time.
And what sort of crowds were you performing to? I mean, was it predominantly Indian, Asian crowds, or was it wider? And what sort of countries were you having to perform?
In the earlier days, it was the market. If we talk about market segments, the market was definitely British Asians. We did do a huge in the early years in Dubai, the Grand Prix. And I think there was about 100,000 there. That was quite a big show. Played with somebody, I don't know. They were on their last legs. Boney M, they were on their last legs at the time. In terms of countries, we went everywhere, actually. So starting from France to Spain, up into the Scandinavia, from Scandinavia down into Germany, from Germany down into Italy, further down into Greece, not forgetting Czech Republic. Yeah, you name it. We did the lot, and it was a fantastic journey. We played with some brilliant artists, probably the best one I think we've seen live. Sir Tom Jones, he was good. He was good. Then in Switzerland at the Palio Festival, we played with Prodigy and Fatboy Slim. Yeah, it was interesting journey, much to learn. You learn about international trade. You learn about international culture. You learn that people buy from people, irrespective of culture, and you learn a lot. My son, who was 10 at the time, was also in the band, interestingly, and he learned more about international business at the age of 10 than most people who would be sitting at home probably playing on their Xbox.
Right, or way back then. I'm trying to think what console would have been around back then, but maybe the Atari. No, that's probably a bit too old. Anyway, we talked there about setting up the band, then setting up a label. Then what was the next step then from there?
I was still on this mission that I wanted to cross into the charts. So I took my material. By this stage, I had now a number of people on my label, a lot of bands on my label. And so then I started to go to a place called Midem, which takes place in Nice, where the film festival is. And every year, all the record companies get together. So all the big boys, Universal, Warners, a lot of the independents, people who run independent companies like myself. So we would go there and you know, we'd be trying to sell product. And you can imagine I was trying to sell a form of music that they couldn't understand the vocal line, a form of music where they couldn't understand the melody, and a form of music where they couldn't understand the instrumentation. It was probably the most difficult task to sell to a Greek, to an Italian, to an American, that form of music. They just said, sorry, nobody understands this. Nobody wants it. And then eventually, gosh, I've been doing this about 6-7 years, spending a fortune going abroad to all these trade fairs. I managed to convince a small Italian company to take one of our tracks, Mondiato Bacche.
The rock in the building. Cali, what's up, Ramel? What's up, Burrell in the house? Nimi ato gundi tere baake rakhla, palle te mukhran baake rakhla.
And actually, as the months elapsed, we started to hear what was going on. And then I got a call from Germany. Gosh, I remember I was just walking down the street when the call came, and he said, and he played the track to me on the phone, and he said, "Is this yours?" I said, "That's right." He said, "We'd like it for the German European market." And I suddenly started to think, hold on, there's some merit here now. And then we did the deal. I think it was Universal. we did the deal for Europe. Then America came knocking. They were interested. Then we managed to give it to Sony in the UK. I knew it was, something was happening. It was when I was on Oxford Circus. I was walking down London, and I heard the track. I turned around. Summer, nice summer day. I turned around. There's a Beatle. The roof was off, and there were five people dancing to the tune. The only difference was they were white people. They weren't Asians. That's when I knew we were on our way. And then, so 2002, November, it went into the German charts, and it went at number two. And then when I went back to Meadam, so, you know, 6-7 years, they'd disappear down alleyways when they saw me coming with a rucksack full of CDs. And I walked in, and just as I left the UK, I was told we had a number 10 hit on our hands. And by the time Top of the Pops, do you remember the Top of the Pops? There used to be charts on a Sunday morning. And that Sunday morning, the word came through, we'd crossed into top five. So a Punjabi track sung in Punjabi with Punjabi instrumentation, Punjabi melody, had crossed into the mainstream charts.
I mean, it was such a huge moment because I was looking through just some of the countries it hit number one, and they were like Belgium, Hungary, Italy, Greece. You know, these are countries that you would never think such a track would do so well in. It was just phenomenal. I remember being on holiday in, I think it was Tunisia. Mundial de Bache was playing everywhere. It was just, you couldn't get away from it during that period. It was just phenomenal. Yeah, I think it was a really proud moment for everyone, not just yourself.
And of course, when Jay-Z came on board, that little known rapper said, "We love the tune, we'd like to be featured on there." And we knew, obviously, that in order to break America, we needed somebody like that.
Right. Fantastic. I guess, was there ever a moment where you did think and doubt yourself and feel like stopping and feeling that actually this isn't going to happen, I should perhaps give up?
Yeah, well, look, there were numerous times. I can give you one, really, one poignant time. So one weekend, whilst we were doing well in the Asian market, in one weekend, three large distributors of mine went bust. So it's a bit like now in the coronavirus where suddenly trade stops. So I had a big company in Malaysia go bust on me. And I think it was two companies, one in America and two in East London. And suddenly I was hemorrhaging cash, the very thing I used to do when I was back at Lucas. And I remember going into, and my wife said, it's at almost 10 o'clock, my wife said, "Look, why don't you pop down to Blockbuster?" Do you remember something called the Blockbuster?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And said, could you get a DVD for my son? And I remember going into a cash machine and it swallowed my card, because actually I didn't have a pound to my name, because those people had pulled all their money there. And what bailed me out was that by the time I got to Blockbuster, because I was going to try and plead a DVD off him, Blockbuster was shut. But actually, when I got home that evening, I thought, crikey, is this what it's come to? And you can almost hear in your ears your parents saying, 2 degrees, a master's, a lucrative career management consultancy, and now you actually literally haven't got a pound to your name. But you know something, you've just got to keep at it. And, long story short, I went to see the bank manager, sorted it all out, allowed me to trade my way out, and allowed me then to still, a couple of years later, fulfill that dream of having a mainstream global Bhangra track in the charts.
What was the next step then after all of that success? I guess for many people, they perhaps would have said, we're done.
Yeah, well, it's a good point, because you're right. It was a difficult, the next move was difficult. But two things happened. We'll talk about disruption now. Mm-hmm. So two things happened. I then thought, well, look, this is not going to happen again. You don't get a top five UK hit, 9 number ones, every year. And I'd have done what I'd set out to do. So I then diversified, still kept the label going, but then I added another arm, which is around event production. And we'll go to that a bit later on, event production. But what I didn't see And what I didn't see while the event production was well, I didn't see what was happening around me. And what was happening around me was, now fast forward 2007, somebody called Mr. Jobs came around and produced something called the iPhone. Now, we had issues before that because something called Napster was allowing people to use email and the internet to download tracks for free. And so how we, the music industry, reacted was, well, you can't download our tracks for free. We've spent a fortune making these tracks. So we set about, we being the industry, set about suing the spotty teenager next door who didn't have the money to buy, and the aging aunt next door to that who suddenly had discovered the wonders of the internet and could also download for free. So the industry started to sue its very consumers and customers that were now downloading for free. What we failed to recognize was a changing consumer environment. What we failed to understand was how the consumer now looked at music. And what we failed to understand was the disruption of technology. And whilst we wrestled with that, and, you know, we were suing everybody in town, behind the scenes, suddenly the iPhone popped out. And now actually for 99p or 79p, you could download any track you want, whenever you want. So it could be 2 o'clock in the morning. You didn't have to buy a product that was given to you, in other words, an album. You could now choose the track you want. You didn't need a power source. In other words, you didn't need an LP player. Or I know Walkman started to come in and you could run around with them, but you could actually have it straight on your phone. And you didn't need to go to a shop that was open between 9 and 5. You could download it at 3 in the morning. Actually, it was the first time we came across something called instant gratification. You could download now. And we didn't see that. And of course, once we'd woken up, it was a bit late. And now suddenly the whole market changed. So from having a unit full of CDs and you know, having big warehouses loading all CDs and employing people whose job was just to, when the CDs came in, pack them up, send them out for export. Suddenly we needed people with a different skill set. People understood digital, understood computers, understood logging, understood how the marketplace was working technology-wise. And suddenly you didn't need all this space and you needed to re-employ, deploy, and look at a new form of employee that understood the digital world. And of course, what we'd realized straight away was that if it happened to us and the music was the first to be disrupted, others would follow. And the next field that was quite clear to us that would follow would be film. And so I made a reference to Blockbuster. They were the next to go. The shops, HMV, Our Price, they went. Wholesalers who would buy from us and then give them to retail outlets on Soho Road or on some of the major roads. The wholesalers went bust because the shopkeepers said, well, people have stopped coming in buying physical product. They're digitally downloading. So all the people who used to do the artwork for us, all the people who used to duplicate CDs for us, they went bust because there was no customers. Everybody in that supply chain got removed. And it's the first time I came across the word disintermediation. So in other words, you look at the value chain and you remove a number of activities out of it. Retailer disappeared, wholesaler disappeared, the CD manufacturer disappeared, and all that was left for a label to do was the marketing. And the distribution disappeared because now you could buy a track in Singapore. So example, if we were releasing a track today in the old economy, we would have to ship the CDs. It'd take about 5 days to get over there, so there'd be a 5-day lag. But now, of course, if you're in Singapore, you press the button same time as somebody in the UK. So whilst the market was bigger, it was easy to access, the return on your investment model had changed. And you know something? You know, people are sort of saying, well, look, we're in a dire place with the coronavirus. Where do we go from here? Well, what I was and what we were experiencing wasn't a time problem. We were experiencing a structural problem. The structure of our industry had changed forever. and had made our business model redundant. Because in this instance, your business models aren't redundant. It's just the market's disappeared for a short time. So I've been here before. So I've been in that painful position where really, even if the doors open tomorrow with our existing model, we were redundant. Time wasn't an issue anymore. The market had moved on. People had moved on. And it was our inability to understand the customer journey and to understand actually we couldn't be product focused, which is what we were. So we would produce a CD and say to the market, here you go, and you have to buy the entire CD, whether you like it or not. And you're going to have to buy it at a shop, whether you like it or not. And you're going to have to buy it at a shop between 9 and 5, whether you like it or not. And the shop might be shut on a Sunday and in the evenings. That's your problem. Of course, the marketplace was saying, no, actually, we want to buy it now. And we want to buy it when we want to buy it. And we'll buy it in the format we want to buy it. And we'll listen to it. We want to listen to it. And we want to be mobile with it. And the market's moved on. And it's disruption is now, I mean, I say to people, make sure you disrupt yourself. And it's a brilliant quote somebody said to, I was chairing this chair of a panel of fantastic entrepreneurs. And one of them was somebody who used the internet to sell property. And I said to him, look, you don't need to network anymore because, you know, you disintermediate, you remove. So why would you need to talk to the consumer? And he said, brilliantly, he said, well, I need to network because I need to spot in that room new ideas from people, and I need to spot the guy who's going to disrupt me and put me out of business. And I'd better disrupt myself before somebody does it to me. So I think that's how businesses now need to understand change, understand the environment, and quite frankly, spend a lot more time understanding the marketplace they work in, consumer trends, how people are using the internet, how people are buying goods, and maybe just as much doing that as they are looking at their own product.
I think that really does resonate with perhaps many of our sort of listeners in terms of working in those environments where they are being disrupted in so many different ways. I worked in telecoms for 10 years, and when I read the story of Jio, Indian telecoms company, and how they, within 6 months, had acquired over 100 million customers, it totally disrupted the whole market in India. You know, in the past, if somebody had said, how long is it going to take us to launch some software? Typically 6 months to a year would have been the timeline. But if we think about the opportunity cost now, especially with someone like Jio, they've come to market within 6 months. So never mind building a software product, they've launched a whole offering.
When we talked about that the writing was on the wall, I was a bit like an ostrich in the sand. I just couldn't see what was going on. So we diversified very quickly. So the label kept going. We understood that, you know, for all those reasons I said, you'd return on investment. So I looked at my skill set and the organization's skill set. We understood branding, we understood marketing, because obviously that's what we did with artists. So we then applied that into event production. So we thought we could do, you know, we could put on events. And I became president of the local Chamber of Commerce, the Black Country Chamber of Commerce. So I started to meet a lot of entrepreneurs. And I was also the chair of the Asian Business Association, Black Country. So I started to meet a lot of Asian entrepreneurs. And what became clear to me was that for entrepreneurship and for society to benefit, we needed more entrepreneurs. And for entrepreneurs to realize their potential, we needed to make sure that they were connected and that they celebrated what they do and see other people being celebrated. But equally, they learn how to become even better entrepreneurs. And so really the mission became that, well, actually, what we'd like to do is make society a better place. But to make society a much better place, you need to encourage entrepreneurship, who then create the wealth that employ people, and collectively we all pay more tax. That allows us then to have a fully functional NHS, teachers, fire service, the police. So that became my new mission, if that sort of makes sense. And through that, so we sort of started putting our own brand of events together. So we had the Signature Awards, which take place in Birmingham and were due to take place in London and Manchester. And then we have the Natural Entrepreneurship Awards in Leicester, and we have the Natural Business Awards in the Black Country. So what we do with there, there's three things then. So we try and bring all the entrepreneurs together in one room. So we have 600 of the sort of high achievers and people who do really well in business. And we have stakeholders and politicians, so we can all learn from each other. We have a normally good keynote speaker, so we learn from keynote speakers. We've had some fantastic ones. We've had Lord Billamaria from Cobra Beer, Piers Linney, one of the dragons. We've had Paul Bassey, who's a fantastic property investor and sort of invests a lot in the Midlands. We've had Sir John Peace, who's the chair, ex-chair of Burberry. So he's been a speaker. Kavita Broy, who comes on The Apprentice. She's normally one of the panelists. So she's spoken. Lord Paul, the Capario Group. So we've had some real Paul Thandy, who's the CEO of the NEC Group. So we have some real powerful people. What it's enabled me to do, though, is meet these people. And I can tell you, you can spot some of the characteristics. And so here are some of the things I've learned from meeting these people. And I think how I've benefited is, my advice to anybody out there is, surround yourself and meet people that are better than you. Ideally, meet people that are better than you, but not from your industry. Because you're going to learn a lot more outside of your industry. Because if you stay within your industry, you tend to develop what we call groupthink. You all think the same. But if you meet people outside your industry, you'll get a different perspective. Remember the ostrich in the sand? You won't get that then. You see, you'll hear about things outside that you can learn from. Remember the guy who said, I want to disrupt myself before someone else does it? Well, you spot these things if you talk to people who are different from you and work in different places. So, but they all have the same characteristics, which is they're very driven. I'm telling you, they are very driven people. They're very smart people, very intelligent people, because they work hard at what they do. They're very focused. Interestingly, they're visionaries, but know the detail at the same time. I know that sounds a bit strange. They know the big picture, but also know the small picture. They generally know their numbers. They know their numbers well. They know what's happening on a weekly basis. And their attention to detail is really, really good. But I tell you one thing they have, which is amazing. They work extremely hard. None of them have got there without the work. And I find them the most amazing company to sit with. Because you can just see the way the brain ticks, and the way they think, the way they assimilate information and the knowledge. And I think the other thing I would say to people, and I'll tell you what else I met entrepreneurs. So the other thing I would say to people is, put something back into your community and join and assist and help people with the skill set you've got. So I sit on a number of boards. So I sit on the local Black Country Local Enterprise Partnership Board, and I sit on a couple of other big boards. And what you get from them is two things. Firstly, you're sitting with a creme de la creme. Again, they're not from your industry. So you sit with them and you learn from them. And secondly, when you walk into those meetings, as you shut the door behind you and take your seat, actually you've parked your business outside. Because once you've walked in that room, your agenda then is, what can we do for somebody else? And that mind shift is really good, because it enables you to think of other people. It enables you to learn from others on how to think of other people first. And it means when you walk back outside, it actually enables you to then crystallize and analyze your own business at the same time. Does that make sense? So it's almost an inside-outside perspective. And I think I would say to people, honestly, try and mix with people, and I say this from a diversity perspective, people who look different to you, people who speak differently to you, and people who dress differently to you. And if you do, I guarantee there'll be something you will learn from there. Learn from them. And life's all about lifelong learning. if you continue to learn something new every day from somebody new every day, your business will thrive.
Such good advice there, Ninda. Thank you for that. Successful agile organizations particularly focus on the importance of people and building long-lasting relationships. How important is this for entrepreneurial success? Because you talked a little bit about the entrepreneurs themselves, but I guess all of them will have teams behind them that help with that success.
Yeah, I think a couple of things. What was very interesting is when you sit with these entrepreneurs is at what point they learn to let go. Does that make sense? That's quite a hard skill to work out. At what point do you say, right, I'll now give this responsibility to Mr. X and Miss Y? And I think that's the point when the business grows, is when they can do that. And I think in today's social media driven environment, I think the way your brand grows or doesn't grow will determine your future. So people still buy from people. People work with people, and that actually is your brand. And your brand is how you work with people. The logo and everything else is ancillary. That's not your brand. The brand is the culture, and the brand is the way in which your company or brand interacts with the external environment. Also interacts internally. In other words, the culture of the place internally, how well that is run. So I think whilst people say, oh, social media has changed everything, and we did talk about disruptive technology, social media is only one tool, and social media will only reflect what the brand does internally and externally. If you ignore people, then you do so at your peril. And the classic example, what's happened over the last 3 weeks? We've been told not to mix with the people. And what's that done? That's brought the economy to a standstill, because actually it's people meeting people that makes an economy work. So if you wanted a classic example of the importance of people meeting people, treating people properly, and the role of people meeting people, today's environment and crisis actually fully encapsulates that. I think it's absolutely essential. And I think you can't rely on social media anymore. I think you can connect with someone, but you'll only do a big deal once you've met them and looked them in the eye. That's the only way you're ever going to do a big deal. Nobody does a big deal on social media. So how you treat people internally, how you treat people externally, the level of integrity you use, how you communicate with them, how you work with them in the short term and the long term, I think will be crucial to the success of yourself and your personal brand.
I know you recently got a fantastic accolade from the Queen herself. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. It was a proud moment. I was appointed Deputy Lieutenant of the West Midlands, and I deputised for the Lord Lieutenant.
Wow.
That was quite an accolade, because it said I'd done something right somewhere, that they thought it was something they could give to me. And you know something, I've always said, if you put your way out to help other people, so I get calls all the time, can you help me with this, connect with this, and I don't mind doing that, because at the end of the day, if I can help someone else, then I believe in karma, it comes back, and I think maybe that's what people saw. But you know, I'm interested in making sure that society flourishes. But for that to flourish, I know you need enterprise, you need a commercial environment, you need people with jobs, you need to make sure that people can get fund things. And for that to happen, you need new businesses that requires entrepreneurs that are interested in wealth creation for themselves and all their employees and the local community. And if you've got that abundance type of mentality, in other words, to help other people, then it normally should all come back. And of course, you know, wealth should be all inclusive. Wealth should be for everybody. Everybody should have an opportunity to excel. We were all born with potential, and we've got to make sure that everybody has the scope to realize that potential. And of course, you know, if we can do that, then everybody's got a bright future, irrespective of gender, irrespective of age, irrespective of background, and interestingly, irrespective of class. It doesn't matter where you come from, doesn't matter how you speak, doesn't matter how you dress, Doesn't matter what you look like, you should all have the same opportunity to excel. And I think that's the bigger goal, and that's what I'm interested in.
Talking about goals, so as I said at the start of the podcast, you've achieved what many could only dream of, but what are your biggest motivations and what are your plans for the future?
Plans for the future, so as I said, we're doing events in the UK, but we're now looking to take that out. So in 2022, I'm going to get my dates right, we're looking to take the Signature Awards to India, Delhi. So this is in a post-Brexit era where hopefully we can get more trade between India and the UK. And if that works well, the plan is then to go into next door, which is Pakistan. We're also potentially looking at other territories such as the Middle East and South Africa. Would also like to widen the ecosystem and maybe bring other products on board where entrepreneurs can benefit and hopefully create more wealth. And then it's all a circular movement, so everybody benefits. So really, we're interested in creating better societies, better entrepreneurs, more wealth creation. And if I can play a small cog in that, and if natural can play a small cog in that, then it's the same principles that led me to believe that Bhangra music could one day cross into the charts. And there's no reason why the UK cannot, and still is, and cannot be even a better place to trade, both from a economics perspective, but also from a society perspective.
Fantastic. Thank you. What a lovely note to finish off on. There's no comeback for Janak.
Well, interestingly, we still do the odd show. We just did one, I think, about a month ago in Birmingham, and I think next year we'll probably do a few in Europe. Not as many as we used to be able to have time for. I tell you, it's a different feeling, because it's a different feeling in the sense that it's so radically different from what we do during the day, if that makes sense. Does that
and
make sense?
And do you still get that same buzz when you get up on that stage?
Balance gives you a different balance. I also believe, that I think one of the things I did learn from playing with the Janak is I think the importance of music at schools. And I think if we're going to produce a future workforce that is more creative, I think we need to increase the value and the understanding of music in a school curriculum. Because I think, I mean, if you look at some of the top surgeons and the top scientists, I can tell you they're accomplished musicians. And one of the things I think as a society we've lost sight of is the role of art and the role of music in the development of an individual and the development of a society and the development of culture. And I think we should encourage, and I know that from the Janak days, and when I still go to stage, it's a different feeling. You think differently. And even when we're on stage, we're managing a group of people performing in a particular way. There's still a lot of teamwork, but there's a lot of innovation and a lot of creativity. And managing that innovation and creativity is quite good, but it forces you to think outside the box. And I think if industry and society is going to continue to move forward, particularly in the world of robotics, in the world of artificial intelligence, in a world where the mundane jobs, the jobs that people used to be able to do by repetition, are fast disappearing, we need to build people with a creative bent if we're going to continue to grow as a society as we've done in the past. So I think disruptive technology is important, but I think just as important is developing a workforce that has creativity as part of its DNA. And that starts with children at school.
I wholeheartedly agree with that. And I've seen teams that we've sort of coached in the past where we have really bright people, the most fantastic sort of programmers. But then often when they're asked to innovate or come up with creative ideas, because we often don't have that balance in the team, we find that some teams really struggle. And I absolutely can see where you're coming from on that. Just very finally then, Ninda, so I was going to use a small snippet of Monday at the Bajke in this podcast. I hope you're not going to charge me any royalties for that one.
Feel free.
Fantastic. There you go. I've got permission from the man himself. Excellent. I've also been using Monday at the Bajke at a lot of conferences, actually. So I've probably made you a few bucks by raising the awareness. So there's my excuse for not paying you any royalties at those events. But no, thank you so much for your time today, Ninda. Are there any final words, any final thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Look, it's pretty challenging testing times. But someone who's been through previous recessions, went through a structural change, which means I had to think completely different. I'm hoping this will be a V-shape recovery. So it'll come down quickly, but we'll come back up quickly. I think human beings and business particularly and entrepreneurs are very resilient. And so whilst they may appear to be challenging times, I think for most of us who are now used to change, this is just another element of another change that we just need to take in stride and just run with it. And hopefully we'll be back on the road quickly, and hopefully we'll be better at what we do. But I tell you one thing we'll never forget, is the importance of people and the importance of meeting people and the importance of talking to people. And I think that's the one thing, you asked me that question earlier, I think that's the one thing we will have all learned, is that we need to be constantly adapting and responding to change, but never forget the role of people.
Super. Thank you so much, Ninda. I really appreciate your time today and look forward to talking to you more in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, and have a great week.